Mr. Griffiths, the UN's top aid chief, you'll be aware of the increasing dangers for humanitarians moving around Gaza and the complete breakdown in law and order inside the enclave. Now we have reports that senior UN officials have issued an ultimatum on stopping aid into the Gaza Strip unless the situation improves. And this is as a full 500,000 people face the very real threat of starvation. What's your response, please?
My response is very clear. It's not an ultimatum. We continue, as we have done for these many, many months, to negotiate with the Israeli authorities and others, with a lot of help, by the way, from the US, as you know, to get the right conditions to allow aid to be delivered safely and securely. So we're not running away from Gaza at all. But what is true now, and I think that's the basis for this story, is, of course, that we are particularly concerned about the security situation in Gaza, and it is becoming more and more difficult to operate. But it's a continuing discussion, and the discussion is proceeding. We are discussing it daily with Israeli authorities, principally through Gilles Michaud, our head of security for the UN, as well as other people in the field.
In terms of the status quo now, I mean, status quo, what a term to use for Gaza. What's the very latest you're hearing today from your aid teams who are desperately trying to get in, putting their lives on the line to help these most vulnerable people?
Well, you know, we keep saying it can't get worse than it does. It's been getting worse. As you know, we've got some recent figures out about people potentially at risk of famine, but some also some slightly good news there, a lower number than we had feared, just under 500,000 across the whole of Gaza. But aid delivery has never been so difficult as it is now in Gaza. And that is the crucial, brutal truth. And if we don't see an improvement in this, in the security context, for all our agencies, not just the United Nations, local organizations, international NGOs, then we're just going to be failing the people of Gaza. We'll keep on at it, but we fail them daily. Every time we're not able to get aid through to the people who need it.
Yeah, I just want to pick you up on that point. I mean, you said there's slight improvement in the scale of hunger and the threat of starvation in the north, I think it was. But come on, you cannot be happy. I know you're not happy with the fact that a full 500,000 people, 500,000 people, at serious risk of hunger and dying.
Yes, I would definitely, absolutely insist on that. The point I'm making, I think, is that aid can make a difference. If aid gets through, it saves lives. It has had an impact on those vulnerable, still astronomically large numbers, as you rightly point out, the famine, you know, which is the far end of the spectrum. But aid can make a difference. That's why we need to get all those crossings open. That's why we need safety and security. That's why we need the pier to restart and get those aid off the beach, if that can be done too. We need all hands on deck for this.
Now, moving away from Gaza, apart from its awfulness that we hear about every single day, and you must be totally immersed in it, and the amount of phone calls you're making to people involved in facilitating that aid, I can't imagine how busy you must be. But we've also got the West Bank just across the way. That's seeing a spike in violence against Palestinians, with 500 killed since the 7th of October, which is a significant rise in comparison with previous years. There's also the Lebanon escalation. And my question to you is the United Nations ready and able to cope with such a development?
I think the people who need to be ready and able to cope with such a development are the people practicing political diplomacy to stop the threats, as you rightly, I think, point out, to Lebanon, to stop the facts about what's going on in the West Bank. Yeah, aid agencies, humanitarian aid agencies, we're ready. And I don't think it's just the United Nations. But, you know, we're not solving the problem. We're just hoping to help people get through this. But the problem is a political one. And that's the real effort. That must be the focus of all our efforts. And indeed, one of the interesting aspects of the Middle East is that there is a lot of political diplomacy, a lot of mediation going on. By the way, I wish we could see that elsewhere, like in Sudan, but we need to see it bring results. I think it's never been as worrying as it is now, that the way in which this turmoil, the way in which the regionalization of the conflict, the threat to the West Bank, which is, I think, existential, as you rightly described it, that I think is very alarming. So it's not about whether the UN aid agencies are ready. It's about whether the world is going to pitch in to stop this going south.
Maybe we'll get back to that international will or not in a little bit, but let's just talk about you a little bit. You've been in humanitarian action for decades, on the edges of war zones, you say, and in the diplomatic corridors of power. And I'll let you decide whether you tell us which one of those settings you prefer. But now that you're coming to the end of, let's say, 40 years of humanitarian work, and this particular chapter, 3 years or so as the UN's top aid official, please, please give us your key takeaway, because you've said that you're leaving the world in a worse place than when you arrived. And that's rather a depressing thought, I have to say. Nonetheless, at the same time, we've also heard about the incredible resilience of people affected by emergencies, Gazans using spoons to dig septic tanks so they have a bit of dignity. And I wonder if that's something that's kept you going over these last very difficult years in the job.
It sure has. You know, the humanity of ordinary people like the rest of us, you know, you and me and the rest of the world, is undented by the struggles that we see and the spread of war. And I've had the privilege, as you know, in these last 3 years in particular, but before that too, over a lifetime, of seeing that humanity at work. You know, one of the places that I found that most vividly was in Tigray, when I started this job back in 2021. And I went up to Tigray, which the war was raging, as you know, and the threat of famine, which is, by the way, still there. It was the local communities which were the frontline workers helping people survive the displaced. That's true in Burkina Faso. That's true across the world. So the first point I'd make is humanity is not diminished. It's a deep, deep well. Number two, we delivered aid to 144 million people last year. That's two-thirds of what we hoped to reach at a time when funding was problematic. The aid agencies, and it goes back to the point I was making earlier about Gaza, the aid agencies are doing an extraordinary job. And in particular, within the aid agency, the frontline deliverers, you know, I had the privilege of meeting representatives from the emergency rooms, you know, the Sudanese civil society organizations from across the country, by the way, came out to visit, to brief, and who then went back and are still working on those front lines back in Khartoum, back in across the country. They don't go away. And they are, you know, they are the standard, I think, for all of us to be able to say, yes, this is definitely worth it. This is worth every effort because, and I believe this fundamentally from my life, one life saved makes it worthwhile. And I am amazed by the resilience of communities. And I am amazed by the courage of aid workers.
You said that some 140 million people around the world are receiving emergency assistance from the United Nations, and that's a huge number. I mean, that's an amazing achievement, isn't it? And yet it's still not enough, because more than double that number are likely in crisis around the world, as you well know. So as the UN's top aid chief, do you have any insight? Do you have an answer at a time when so many of these vulnerable people have been trapped in emergencies for many years? Do you have a radical idea that might help these people? I mean, do you support, for instance, the idea of a new global fund to protect the world's natural resources like water, health, education, and that will protect people from poverty, conflict and climate shocks? Or am I just being incredibly naive?
No, I don't think you're being naive at all. I think it's time for radical solutions. But there are two different kinds of radical solutions. One is the funding one that you've just described. And I think my successor and the Interagency Standing Committee, the committee that brings all of us, not just the UN, all humanitarian agencies together, can, should, must look at dramatic changes. You know, I recently pointed out the difference between investment in war and investment in humanitarian aid. It's a ludicrous contrast. But the other extraordinary reform that is needed, radical, is to make listening to the communities our place of programming priorities. So we need to make them tell us what they need most. That saves money, but that's not the reason for it. It builds respect, and it's much more likely to improve resilience. There is some good news, incidentally, since the last COP, on the way in which climate adaptation money is beginning to come through with the help of the humanitarian community as well to frontline communities who've done nothing to create the climate crisis, but are ones usually on the front lines of suffering. Somalia, for example, there's a very interesting record. Southern Africa, where colleagues have been working on the El Nino issue. So there is good news as well. I think what is really important now is not to worry about whether the Security Council is divided or whether multilateralism is at risk. What's much, much more important and much more interesting is that we are beginning to see the end of an era, I hope, of anger and the beginning of an era of change. We need in the UN, in civil society, in host governments, across the world, in regional organizations, to start looking at the fact that the power is being redistributed in this world today. And maybe that's not a bad thing either. Maybe that's not a bad thing. There are some really important things that we have to apply. In my community, we need to get rid of impunity. We need accountability for attacks on hospitals, health clinics, and aid workers. We need dramatic improvements in funding. And we need to do this all at the behest of the people in those communities and not what we think is best, but what they know is best.
I've heard that echoed, that message about getting community involvement from the very outset, from many people, many humanitarian coordinators, many of your colleagues, particularly in South Sudan, getting women involved in digging ditches around villages for, you know, to prevent flooding, that kind of thing. And
it's very practical. It's very practical. It's real. It's not imaginary. I've been lucky enough not only to work in the humanitarian world, but I worked also in development assistance back in UNICEF in the days in Asia. And I was able to see that the dramatic gear change that you have when you put people in charge of their own lives. And my God, wouldn't you and I want to be in charge of our own lives? And why shouldn't they?
Looking ahead, given this potential shift in the global power base, which you intimated just now, what advice would you have for your successor? I'm going to be cheeky and ask who it might be, who would be some great candidates for the job. And given how unrelenting your job is, I guess that's something that's unlikely to change. So they're going to need Duracell batteries, aren't they?
I think so. I think the challenge for the job, and it's been a challenge for me and it will be a challenge for whoever gets chosen in, you know, in the coming weeks, is to balance crisis response with the fundamentals that you and I have just been discussing. The need for these reforms, the need for changing the way we do business. Crisis response can take your entire life twice over, travel all the time, respond day in, day out. And of course, you need to do that because humanitarian diplomacy and humanitarian assistance is a dominant feature of the way our world responds to crisis these days. And we discussed this before. But don't do that at the expense of looking into these changes that are absolutely blindingly obviously needed if we are actually going to deliver on our mission and our mandate. So balancing time is the magic elixir. That's the alchemy that we need to see.
I guess we will see that when the appointee is announced in the next few weeks. Last question to you, Martin Griffiths, the United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Emergency Relief. What comes next? What do you have planned? And, you know, are you going to give yourself a rest?
Good God, no. No, I think that would be a disastrous thing to do. Incredibly, incredibly self-indulgent. No, I intend to join the free world and take whatever lessons I've learned and be based in Geneva, which was, you know, a wonderful thing for me because this is where my family lives and was brought up, and carry on with the kind of things that we've been talking about. But doing it from a position where I can pick and choose a little bit more the things to focus on than I have been able to, because the job doesn't allow picking and choosing. You have to be across the landscape. So you ain't seen the end of me yet, I'm afraid. I'll still be around bothering you.
Very good. You haven't answered whether you prefer the corridors of power with their velvet surroundings or the front line.
Well, the thing that I really was knocked out by in these last 50 years were those light bulb moments when, as we've just been discussing, you're listening to a community and they're telling you something and you suddenly realize, oh my God, of course. I had that in Burkina Faso, as you know, when I went to a village called Djibo, which, you know, where the mothers famously crossed Al-Qaeda battle lines at night to find leaves to feed not only their children, but the children of displaced people who came. So, you know, if when you see this kind of courage in the midst of suffering, you're recharged by it and you are invigorated by it. And it's a huge privilege of the people in my community that we get to see this. And yes, the corridors of power are, you know, necessary, but if you don't have the connection to people's agency, tragedy, and recovery, then I think you're diminished. And you need to have both.